John 13. You know, we're not really that aware many times of how real love requires real vulnerability. And to come to that place of really loving as Jesus gave us commandment and example to do is really a major challenge. But in the rest of this chapter, it's really an interesting picture. You have Jesus speaking about Judas, who is about to betray him. And a lot of the chapter's wrapped up in what the other gospel accounts only give us a little tiny insight. John gives us a lot more insight into what was happening and what was going on with the conversation. And people were wondering who it was. And then Judas is finally revealed, even though the disciples still don't get it. Peter and John were kind of in on it. They kind of understood at the end. But this horrible, tragic, traitorous event is followed by Jesus' teaching on love, loving one another. And then that is followed by Peter, who proclaims his loyalty, his commitment, his fidelity. I will go with you wherever, Jesus. I'll go lay my life down for you. And only to find out that he really is quite incapable of that. So you have this incredible picture of love sandwiched on the one side with traitorous Judas and on the other side with weak and impotent Peter. And yet there's something fascinating when I think about God's love. Really, quite honestly, the commandment is way beyond us. Let's not kid ourselves. But not when it comes to the promise the Lord makes. See, he gives us of his Spirit in which now we can love. But it's a love and it's a faith and it's a hope working together. Of course, the greatest is love. But there abides these three things, faith, hope, and love. Now, faith is necessary for us to believe that God will empower us. Hope is necessary to know that no matter how vulnerable we are right now, no matter how difficult it is right now to love, we believe the Lord is going to work it out in the end. And that is the only way you can truly get along with true love. Otherwise, we just kid ourselves and we say loving things to each other, but we really don't love one another. And that is a very tragic thing because then the world looks at this and they're trying to get a good picture. Is there real people in the world? Is there a real Christian? Is there a real person who knows God? Well, Jesus said, by your love for one another, they'll know that you're mine. And so this is a powerful, again, we're looking at John's account of the last week of Jesus, that private, special time with his disciples, very intimate conversations that he has with them and very intimate examples. And so we see this picture unfold before us. Now, the peak of self-interest, Judas, collides with the love of God, which then gives way to the inability of man. And Jesus, you know, when we look at him, and I think it's important to understand, as we look at this passage, we're going to be picking up in verse 18. Understand what Jesus is saying. You know, when he goes on to express this whole thing with Judas, we've got to, I think for a while I would read the Bible and I would kind of make Jesus this superhuman. And he was Superman. He didn't feel anything. He didn't feel any pain. You know, nothing really bothered him. And in one sense, he is God, yes. But in another sense, understand that God became man. Jesus is 100% man. He's 100% God, but he's 100% man. And he did not use his power as God to live as a man any more than he directs us to in dependency upon the Holy Spirit. You can follow this all the way through Jesus' life. He was baptized in the Spirit. He was empowered by the Spirit. He was out in the temptation there, being tempted by the devil, but strengthened by the Spirit. In every respect, it shows Jesus modeling what we should be like. So we've got to get that out of our minds that, well, you know, of course, it didn't bother Jesus at all. No, he was greatly distressed and grieved and hurt. He felt everything we felt. We feel in many respects, but not in the same sense that when we give into sin and when the hurt becomes, you know, clouded with self-interest. He was distressed with the lack of faith with his disciples. He was grieved and his spirit was troubled with this aspect of Judas betraying him. But in every respect, of course, he was a man as exemplified as the Son of God in the sense that he walked above those situations. Now, in a way, think about this for a moment for us. We've got some real life challenges. I mean, you might have an employer that is driving you nuts. You might have a mate that you guys are just oil and vinegar. You might have a situation you're facing in a family that right now it's beyond you. And if anyone knew about it, you'd be totally distraught. But I'll tell you what, when it comes down to the simple matter is the Lord is going to model for us how to handle, how His love is tested. He's going to show us what to do with this one who betrayed Him. Let's jump in. He picks up in verse 18. He says, I do not speak. He kind of actually finishes a thought here. He says to the disciples about the example he set in washing their feet, and if I, your master, have done these things, then you do these things, and happy are you if you do them. And then he says, I don't speak concerning all of you. I know whom I have chosen, but that the scripture may be fulfilled, he who eats bread with me has lifted up his heel against me. So in other words, the promises he just gave, he's saying it does not apply to all of them. There are some, apparently, who were not his. And then he quotes this passage in Psalm 41, which is a passage, it's a Psalm of David, as he is lamenting over the betrayal of Ahithophel, his loyal counselor. When Absalom, the son of David, betrayed him and rebelled against the kingdom and took over the kingdom, and David was forced to go across the brook Kidron and get out of the city to save his life. And he and his faithful men were with him. He was amazed to find out that his most loyal counselor, the one that he shared meals with almost every day, the one that he confided with his deepest secrets, his deepest issues of his heart, the one he trusted so much with everything in the kingdom, he found out that he'd betrayed him and followed Absalom. And it was a deep hurt for David, and he speaks about it. He says, he who eats bread with me has lifted up his heel against me. But what we find out is oftentimes in the Psalms, the Psalms of David, they're messianic Psalms, that they apply also to the son of David, Jesus. In a situation that you've got the type and then the anti-type. The type there in the Old Testament where you see the picture of what happened, which is fulfilled then in the New Testament with the Messiah. And here it is with the person of Judas. Ahithophel was an interesting character, though. When you follow him, you find a very obscure passage that shows in one of the genealogies that he actually was the grandfather to Bathsheba. And it's quite possible that he had harbored in his heart bitterness over what David did with Uriah, Bathsheba's husband. And that he secretly held on to that. He maintained a front of loyalty, a front of goodness, a front of faithfulness. All the while he was secretly thinking, how can I get rid of him? And this is really the same bitterness, the same personal agenda is found in anyone who betrays, and we see it especially here in Judas. He says, Jesus says, I tell you before it happens or it comes, that when it does come to pass, you may believe that I am He. Now again, Jesus throws another one of those statements there. I am. He is added by the translators. You can see it in italics, so you know that the translators just add that to make the sound of it finish. In normal cases, you would add that. But the phrase I am in the Greek, ego eimi, is a phrase very commonly used among the Jews to refer to the name of God or the person of God. When Moses was sent by God, he said, who can I say who's sending me? And he says, tell them I am that I am is sending you. The great I am, the all-becoming one, the one that is self-existent, not dependent upon anything else. He is. He was, he is to come. And so Jesus uses this same phrase and attributes it to himself and then even shows you the proof. I'm telling you before this happened so that you know I am has said it, that I am God. And of course, this is actually a fulfillment of prophecy. God even challenged a lot of the false prophets in Isaiah 41. He said, hey, show me the things that are come hereafter that we may know that you're God's. Yes, do good or evil that we may be dismayed and see it together. He challenges them. Do something that you tell me something that's going to happen in the future. Now, there's a lot of prognosticators and psychics and people who profess to know the future or have an insight into the future. And I want to tell you, when you really look at what's being said, they're so clever. They're very, very crafty because they're vague and they're set up. And, you know, Satan, understand, even if he does have, and I believe that there are a lot of frauds in the psychic world, but those people that are really communicating with demonic entities, they may be told a certain thing is going to happen, but you know, there could be certain aspects to the way Satan and his agents can set those things up. You're going to meet a tall, dark, handsome person. this afternoon? Well, you know, Satan is no dummy. He's got agents out there. He's got plenty of people in his court that are tall, dark, and handsome. He could send your way, and then you're like, oh, how did they know? You know, we can't be naive as to realize that the spiritual world is not there. But when it comes to truly telling the future and knowing the end from the beginning and knowing everything that's going to take place, only God knows. Satan can make some educated guesses. He can even craftily set things up. But he cannot tell the future. Only the Lord can, and this is the distinct aspect of God. So Jesus says this. He says, most assuredly, I say to you, he who receives whomever I send receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. In other words, he's setting them up to know, hey, I know there's going to be a guy that's going to betray me. You either receive me or you don't. But if you receive me, you're receiving him who sends me. And then he who receives you is receiving me. You know, it's like you see the chain there. You go out in the name of the Lord. If people receive your testimony for what God has done in your life, they're really receiving what Jesus has said. And then if they receive Jesus, then they receive the Father. So this is what the Lord is expressing. Now, when Jesus had said these things, notice he was troubled in spirit and testified. Here's Jesus troubled in spirit. Again, the thought of him being immune from any feelings is something we've got to get away from. We've got to understand that he experienced what we experience. Now, a lot of times people say, well, wait a minute. How can Jesus really know everything that I've experienced? Because, you know, he's never done drugs. He's never done, you know, gotten drunk. He's never done all those things. You know, how can he really know how hard it is to fight the temptation of these types of situations? Very simple answer for that. You don't know the strength of temptation until you resist it. You see, those of you who have given in to temptation don't know the strength of temptation. Because when you give in, you're relieved of it now. When you resist from day one all the way through, that is a signal of some incredible strength. You see, that's the type of person that understands the strength of temptation, not the person who gives in. When you give in, you haven't known how much farther it can go. You don't know how much more deeply it can affect you. And so in a way, when you look at Jesus and experiencing the experience, he did go in our place. He is our high priest who is not unaware of all of our weaknesses and feelings and struggles, because he was tempted in every respect, yet without sin. But here we find him troubled. Troubled. Troubled in spirit. And testified, saying, most assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me. Well, the disciples looked at one another, perplexed about whom he spoke. You know, the statement now, the betrayal is going to come. Did Jesus just realize it at this time, or did he already know from the very beginning that Judas would betray him, even when he chose him? I've wrestled over this because, you know, to say that Jesus didn't know makes him less than the Son of God. But understand, again, he was completely dependent upon the Holy Spirit, as we should make ourselves. And the Lord will show us exactly what we need. And, you know, if you ask Jesus, you know, what was the molecular makeup of the Son, you know, being the Son of God, he should know that. But would he have known that at that time? Is that something the Holy Spirit would have revealed in his human frame? I would have to say probably not. Because Jesus, in Philippians, it says, emptied himself. When he's the Son of God, equal with the Father, but when he became a man, the kenosis, that Greek word which means emptied himself into that form of a man. That is, he purposely, willingly limited himself in scope and became dependent upon the Spirit and the Father. And so I believe it's quite possible. Again, this is just speculation, and you could toss this out if you want, but it's quite possible that when Jesus originally chose Judas, he didn't suspect anything. And as time went on, Judas covered himself so well. In fact, all the other disciples are totally shocked to think that there's someone that... And they don't even suspect Judas. What does that tell you about Judas? He wasn't obvious. He was the last person they would have thought, perhaps. They couldn't figure it out. Everybody's probably eyeing Peter, you know? No, I'm sure they weren't. I'm sure Peter was worried about that, though. But the point is that could it be that when the time came, the Spirit revealed to Jesus who it was, and now he's troubled in spirit. And he speaks this, one of you will betray me. And the disciples looked, and they don't know what's going on. You know, there are Ahithophels, there are Absaloms, there are Judases in our own lives. We will have people like that. You know, if our master experienced it, we're going to experience it. Don't think that we're greater than our master. There are many people who proclaim their loyalty, but faithful people are hard to find. Now, the danger is someone that takes a position of being ultra suspicious then. And, you know, they're worried about being deceived and they're never trusting anyone. I'm never going to trust anyone again. Have you ever been burned by somebody and said that? I'm never going to trust anybody again. I remember a particular girl that I really thought, this is going to be my wife, you know. And it just, God just kept closing doors and closing doors. And I was so frustrated with God. I said, I'm never going to look at another woman as far as I'm concerned now. That's it. I just was burnt out on it. I'm not going to trust another situation. But, you know, the funny thing is we feel that. And I remember what an old wise man said. He said, better to be deceived 100 times than live a life of suspicion. But this is where love comes in. You see, love is willing to take a risk. Love is willing to take a chance. And love also knows it's going to be hurt. You love anyone, your heart is going to be broken at some time or another. It is the way it is. You don't want your heart broken? Keep your heart. Wrap it up in some luxuries and pleasantries of this life and keep it all to yourself. And C.S. Lewis mentions that you can keep it in the coffin of your selfishness and there it will remain intact. It will never be broken. It will become eventually impenetrable, irredeemable. Sometimes the Lord has to use circumstances in our life to really stretch us. Sometimes he uses people. And here, Judas, you know, Jesus had a Judas. David had Ahithophels and Absaloms. You know, it's amazing how, as David struggled the most over Absalom and over Ahithophel, and Jesus, of course, over Judas, both were traitors. Both were traitors. They had their own agendas, their own motives, their own plans for themselves. They pretend loyalty to gain an advantage, and then they use a hurt or perceived wrong to let it all come out. Isn't that a scenario that's repeated many times? You know, people that are ultra sensitive in the area of, you know, what people say about them or think about them, you know, in many respects, you got to get through that, because if you don't, it's going to eat you alive. You've got to get over yourself. And here Jesus experiences the closest one of his disciples as a traitor now. David did. Satan is an evil person. And he's going to use people. And, you know, I think of how people also, you know, it's like the gossip and the talk and the little insinuations about things and the whispering and the spreading rumors and conjecture. You know, people that sometimes consider themselves to have a gift of discernment are many times just found to be with a critical and, you know, resentful spirit. And it's a problem because I think of people that go out from here, you know, one of the greatest things I can see is someone coming on staff here for a while, getting equipped, being used in ministry, and then going out in the mission field. But, you know, sometimes I hear people conjecture. Now, why did they really go out? You know, was there a problem? Was there an issue? Next thing you know, it's like they're in blatant sin. That's why they left, you know. Or there was a falling out. That's why they left. And people talk. And you know what? I wish that I would love it if you have any questions. First of all, much of it sometimes isn't your business. But if it is your business and you have a need to know, talk to me. I'll be happy to speak to you. Anything, you know, it's amazing how many people get damaged by hearsay and innuendos. And you know what? If you're on the giving end of it, one day you're going to be on the receiving end of it. You know, you won't like it then. But I tell you, we want to keep totally up front. I mean, there have been people who have left, some into missions here, others into different ministries. Some weren't a perfect fit with this ministry, and others struggled with areas. But whose business is that? You know, sometimes when we conjecture and we go farther, we hurt people. And I think of Jesus, how he experienced this, you know, he's disturbed in spirit. But notice what happened. Simon Peter motioned let's back up here to verse 23. They wonder, they're perplexed, they're puzzled who he's speaking about. Well, there was leaning on Jesus' bosom one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. Now, this is at dinner, and this would have been a very common thing. This sounds strange just reading it. He's leaning on his breast. But understand, this was actually the way they would sit at the table. Michelangelo kind of blew it, actually, with the famous painting of the Lord's Supper. They weren't all sitting, you know, in that table facing in one direction, or in that case, they're standing. And they didn't look like monks. But the point is, in actuality, in the Roman triclinium table, which would have been the common table of that day, it was a low table, and you didn't sit, but you reclined. And the idea was, according to, you know, the understanding, is that you would lean. If you were on your back, that wouldn't be lying down. If you were on your right side, that wouldn't be lying down. But lying down was a specific term for on your left arm, leaning on your left arm, so that you had your right arm free to eat. And this is exactly how they would sit around the table. And it was a particular order, too. At the head of the table, which would have been the one side, you would have had the most important guest of honor would have been second. The host would have been first, then second, and then the most important prominent person after that would have been third. That way, the guest of honor, as he's leaning, he would be right in the ear of the host. So if he needed anything, all he had to do was whisper silently, "Hey, could you get me this," or whatever. And, you know, then the host would take care of the situation. In this case, you got an interesting situation here. You got Peter, who you would think would be up there, right? You'd think he'd be at the top of the pile. He'd be the pecking order. In fact, it was very interesting because just like there's a pecking order today in these social places that in those days, you know, you had those prominent three and then it kind of went on down to least important who would have been on the other end of the table. Guess where Peter was? Now, we don't know that for certain, but we do have a hint here because it says, Simon Peter therefore motioned to him to ask him who it was of whom he spoke. Now, if Peter were two or three people down, he wouldn't have been able to get John's attention, who was the one, it says, one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. We know that was John. John doesn't want to mention his own name and brag about himself. But he was the one that was there. He was the beloved disciple. The one whom Jesus loved. Now, I've heard some say he was the loving disciple. Well, understand, he was also nicknamed a son of thunder, so I don't know that qualification, but he was certainly one of the youngest and one of the most beloved, and the Lord used him to write the book of Revelation and the first and second and third John, and of course the Gospel of John. So he was the most prolific among those disciples who were there as far as writing, with the exception, of course, of Paul the Apostle, who wasn't there. But notice what's going on here. Simon Peter motions, so he cannot be anywhere in the vicinity. In fact, you get the feeling that he's on the other side of the table where it curves around so that just motioning, he could get John's attention from across the table. Now, why is Peter sitting in the last seat? Why do you think he's in the last seat? I've heard some conjecture that Peter was listening to Jesus. If you want to be the greatest, be last. You want to be first, be last. So he's thinking to himself, all right, I'm going to apply this. I'm going to take the last seat. Because I'm the greatest. But there he was, kind of out of the loop now, not knowing what's going on. And Jesus is saying, what is going to betray? And it looks like, you know, Peter's out of the loop here. How can you know? So he motions, John, tell him, find out who he is. So it says, leaning back on Jesus' breast, he said to him, Lord, who is it? And Jesus answered, it is he to whom I shall give a piece of bread when I have dipped it. Now this would have been equivalent to a toast. You know, when you dipped your bread in the sauce and then you gave it to somebody, that would be like a toast. And so here is what he's doing. It is he to whom I give a piece of bread when I have dipped. And having dipped the bread, he gave to Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon. And after the piece of bread, it says, notice, Satan entered him. And Jesus said to him, what you do, do quickly. Now that's a lot to be said in just one quick verse. Satan entered him. He became possessed at that time. Satan entered him to do what Satan had intended to do, and that was all along he wanted to destroy Jesus. And now he's got a willing vessel. Now, does it mean that at this point he became demon-possessed, or could it be that he was already under the influence of Satan for a while? I would think that Jesus would have known if that were the case. But what was it about Judas that allowed this to happen? Was he just an all-around good guy until Satan entered him and then he became the bad guy, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, you know, type of thing? No, I don't believe so. Because I don't believe, according to the scriptures, Satan has no power over you unless you give it to him. Otherwise, there'd be a whole lot more demon-possessed people running around. But another thing we have to know is this, and you've got to understand this. You've got Satan entering Judas. Judas was not foaming at the mouth. He wasn't like thrashing wildly about. When we think of someone demon-possessed, now I've seen people that have been under the possessed of Satan, most likely. And, you know, at that point, when it's a visible, obvious thing, it is a horrible thing to behold. It is a horrible thing. But I've also understood that many times people can be under the influence of Satan and not even know it, not even be conscious of it. But they've sold themselves over, they've made up their mind for good. I'm not going to follow God. And I want power, and they'll sell their soul to the devil. And they don't understand what's really happening. But it was the greed, it was the agenda, it was the ambition that Judas had. He had his own agenda for Jesus. He had his own agenda, what he wanted. And now he sees it's not going in that direction. It's quite possible he, at that point, his heart is hardened. Satan enters him, and Jesus says to him, "What you do, do quickly." Now, of course, this must have really freaked Judas out. How does he know? For no one at the table knew for what reason he said this to him. Some thought because Judas has the money box that Jesus had said to him, "Buy those things we need for the feast," or that he should give something to the poor. And having received the piece of bread, he then went out immediately, and it was night. You know, I shudder to think of how many are no longer walking with the Lord who have been stumbled and snared due to Satan's lies. They've found that maybe following the Lord has been difficult. It's not been what they've wanted. They've had their own agenda, and they thought God would bring them from here to there, and this is what they wanted. And if God is not going to take them there, then forget that. I'm going to go somewhere else. You know, there's no one that is in more of a worse spiritual condition than one who walked for a while in the light and then goes back into the darkness. Jesus spoke about those under the demonic possession. He says, when a spirit leaves a man, it goes around in waterless places or dry places seeking another place to live. And when it finds nothing, it will return to the previous person he was in. And if he finds it unkept and empty, then he'll enter in with seven more demons worse than the first. The idea there is that when you have been delivered, when your eyes have been opened and you have seen victory in your life, and then you go back into the world, what you're going to find is that it's going to be seven times worse in the end. You know, this is why we have to have tremendous compassion, you know. But I'll tell you what, the notion that he could put in a person's heart, just as he enters Satan here, he can put notions in people's hearts. Don't underestimate Satan's schemes. There are many times when it's not obvious. Many times it is. Even on a level in how he tries to affect God's children. Now, he cannot possess a Christian. If you're truly born again, I do not believe he can possess you. What has the temple of God to do with idols? How can you have, you know, the light of Christ in you and the darkness of evil? There are people who believe you can be possessed as Christians. I do not see that in scriptures. And of course, you've got ministries that focus on that's the main problem in your life. You've got a demon. You've got a demon of gluttony. You've got a demon of lust. You've got a demon of thievery. You've got a demon of smiling too much. You've got a demon of this or that. And everybody's got a demon. And the whole service revolves around casting the demon out. You know, sometimes burping them up in a napkin. You know, I mean, I'm dead serious. And then going out and you're fine. But the problem is it removes the responsibility from the individual, because basically all you have to do is say, hey, the devil made me do it and I need deliverance. But it's not a scriptural concept by any stretch. However, there are times when, you know, Satan tries to harass and to, you know, oppress and mess with you. I got to tell you, it is sometimes, you know, it's a spiritual battle. And Paul says, on the evil day, stand firm, having girded your loins with truth. Because there are some days that are more evil than others. Have you ever noticed that? There's some days you think, hey, Lord, you and me, man, we're tight. This is awesome. This is the way it's meant to be. A week later, you're like at the bottom. You're like at the dregs. You're like dying. You're like crying. What's going on? God, have you left me? You know, there are evil days. I know as a pastor, it was like clockwork. When the kids were young in the home and I was getting ready on a Saturday for the message on Sunday, I mean, out of the most ridiculous arguments would start. Most ridiculous things would just start, and there'd be frustration and anger. And then I would think, I can handle this. And I'd get in the middle of it, and then we'd all be at it. And I think, what is going on? And you realize, wait a minute, this is Satan's trying to sow strife here. You know, he does that with people. You know, one of his biggest traits is to be the accuser of the brethren before God, but he also loves to sow discord. And he does. And he has lots of agents. He's got lots of agents here in the church at Calvary. I'm convinced of it. They look spiritual. Now, I'm not about to try to figure out who it is, because that's not what the Scripture says. Because they're going to be among us. Bible says, if you find someone you think is, you know, you rip them up. You might be ripping up a true wheat, not just a wheat. You know, you have to wait till it comes to harvest time, and then you see the fruit in the end. But I tell you, people's mouths oftentimes give themselves away. They go on a whispering campaign. They sow dissension. They're factious. That is, like, they'll, in fact, the Bible says reject a factious man after a first and second warning. A factious person, in the old translation it's a heretic, is one who basically just causes you to choose. Makes you keep questioning, you know, well now the pastor says this over here, you know, but what I think is really, you know, over here, you know, and it's this way over here, and, you know, this is what I see it as. And how can he say, and now the best thing to do with something like that is, hey, that's a good question. Let's go ask the pastor. But see, they don't like that. They like to, you know, kind of fly low so that no one actually can expose it for what it is. They like to keep their own little disciples after themselves. They like to keep isolated from the leadership of the church. And you know what? The whispering campaign that happens. Well, you know, the leadership of the church, they're not loving. You know, they don't really care for you. You know, Absalom, one of his traits was that he would sit in the front gate when all the people would come by, and he'd tell the people, oh, you know, my father David, he doesn't really have a whole lot of time to deal with your situation, but, you know, you got a good case, and I think he should hear you. I don't know why he doesn't take the time, but, you know, I'll take the time with you. What's your situation? I'll help you out. And he won the hearts of the people by doing this. By undermining and subverting his father, he won the hearts of the people. They all thought he was the greatest. He's so compassionate and loving and caring. He's spending so much time reaching out to me. And wow, he should be the king. And eventually you had this division in the nation. And it was all because of Absalom's heart was ambitious. You know what people need to do when you have someone that's like maybe telling you about someone in staff or someone in leadership or someone? You know what? Matthew 18, go to the source. That would solve so much. Go directly to the source. You know what? We don't do that, though. You know, because if we go to the source, then we're going to think, well, we're saying something, you know, about someone else. No, ask the question. Get the situation out in the open. Find out what's really happening. You know, there could be a very good reason. And as often as the case, there is. You know, you think Judas's conscience would have been bothered when Jesus says, what you do, do quickly. But here he is, hardened of heart. He gets up and gets out of there. And he goes and makes his deal with the Pharisees for 30 pieces of silver. He already had it in mind. And there he is, betraying Jesus. But then you find, in verse 31, when he had gone out, Jesus said, now the Son of Man is glorified and God is glorified in him. Now, I often wondered about this. Because I could see how the resurrection would be an expression of God's glory. Now you can see he's alive. He's the Son of God. But how is the cross the glory of God? How does that weak moment of Jesus being betrayed and being arrested and being tried and then thrown up on that cross and killed, how is that for the glory of God? You know, sometimes we wonder in our own circumstances, how do I see God's glory in what I'm going through right now? But, you know, here is what he says, that now the Son of Man is glorified and God is glorified in him. By the way, if you're new with us and you see the phrase Son of Man, don't get stumbled over that as to think that, well, that does that mean he's not the Son of God? No, this is actually a messianic phrase that the leaders of the Jews would have recognized him claiming to be the Messiah. This was used in Daniel about the Messiah, the Son of Man. And it was also used in a generic sense, but Jesus, of course, makes his clear statements about being the Son of God in many other places. But understand, he's both the Son of God and the Son of Man, lest he could not be our Redeemer. He has to be man and he has to be God in order to redeem us. If he's just man, then he's going to have a sin nature. And he can only die for his own sins. He has to be sinless. So he has to have God's nature there. But he can't just be God and redeem us because he has to identify with us. So it was necessary he be the Son of God and the Son of Man. But now he's saying he's glorified. Now, how is this possible? Well, this is where we're going to have to close because I don't want to rush the next passage in regard to love. In fact, we're going to see here in this passage, we looked at how love is tested. In the next passage, we're going to see Jesus' expression of it and yet how love is manifest, even through weakness. But look at the glory of the cross. What does it reveal about Jesus? What does the cross reveal about God? Because that's what glorify means. It means reveal. What do we learn about God in the cross? First of all, we learn that God is wise. He provided a plan in which he could take us sinners and bring us to him, a holy God. He wisely developed a plan to bring his banished ones back. But not only that, it shows God's faithfulness. Because from the very beginning, in Genesis chapter 3, he promised to, after they fell in sin and Eve was deceived and she took of the fruit and Adam transgressed and sin entered the world, he promised the woman that her seed would bruise the serpent on his head, though the serpent would bruise him on the heel. He promised the seed of the woman, and Jesus is the seed of the woman. You see, he's keeping his promise. And his death on the cross is going to give the death blow to Satan, the serpent. It also shows God's holiness. See, God is holy. He can't just say, okay, you're forgiven. Why not? Because he's holy. That sin has to be paid for. Everything has to be just. The law must be satisfied. And in this way, he is the substitute. So he keeps his holiness by Jesus' perfection substituting for our sin. And then fourthly, it shows God's love. You know, the redemption, the adoption of us as his children and bringing us into fellowship with him. God's compassion and love that he would go to such lengths of pain and torture that we might have life. This is love. Jesus models it. Even in this betrayal of Judas, he models it. And you know, when we really think about this, it's a humbling experience. Now, the disciples are watching this, and we're going to look the next week about how this new commandment he gives to his disciples, and we'll take a little bit more note about that.